Hey to all you fish enthusiasts out there. Whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, April 8th, 2024, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Liebeck with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska.
And rammer jammer yellow hammer, I'm Guy Uro, and today we're taking you to Alabama to talk about A, the Alabama shiner, B, the Alabama sturgeon, C, the Alabama cavefish, or D, the Alabama shad. If you chose C for cavefish, you are C for correct. That's a long one, long way to get there, but I liked it.
I like it too. We have two excellent guests with us. Bernie Kahaida is an aquatic conservation biologist at the Tennessee Aquarium and joined us in season three for an episode featuring the Barron's top minnow. And Nick Warwa is a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So very happy you both are here with us.
Alabama darter. Come on, Guy.
It's multiple choices usually of four, but Alabama darter. Thank you, Bernie.
I don't think many people have seen this fish in the flesh.
Katrina, you're right. There has not been a lot of people see this fish in person, and I consider myself very fortunate to be able to do that. One of the few, and Bernie Kahaida is definitely another one, and he's really been the front and foremost expert on the fish.
Bernie, maybe you can help us imagine what this fish looks like.
Well, first of all, the name of the genus is Spio platyrhinus. So Spio is underground, platy is flat, and rhinus is snout. So it has a really flat snout that's pinched at the back and then widens as you move forward. It also has a sloping head on the top, and it's a really long head.
It's got a weird head, for sure.
What's really cool is they have allometric growth. Just think about a human baby. If we grew up with heads as big as baby heads, our heads would be this big.
Can't get your arms around it. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, it's the same way with cavefish. So when you have a picture of a small cavefish, it looks like a duck-billed platypus. Its head is much shorter, and that snout is just so flat. But then when they turn into adults, the head gets way more elongate, and the snout isn't quite so platypus-looking. Because it's a cavefish, it shares with other cavefish. It has no eyes, very little pigment. It has its anus jugular right by its throat, like a pirate perch.
Pirate perches now.
That's right. There's five species of pirate perches now. It's got an expanded branchial chamber. And what that means is underneath the flaps over its gills, it's got a really large area. We think all cavefish, they lay their eggs, they get fertilized, and then the female, she stores them in that chamber next to her gills and then underneath those branchiostical membranes and broods them there. Of course, we have almost zero data on that. We know nothing about the life history of most cavefishes, especially the Alabama cavefish. Because it's a cavefish, it shares with other cavefish, it has no eyes, very little pigment. Its head and body is covered with these canals and these sensory hair cells in them. And that's how a blind fish moves around without any eyes. As it moves, it's pushing a little water out in front of it. That water bounces off a rock, bounces back, and it feels that water in those pores in those canals. And it moves those little sensory hair cells. And they're like, oh, there's a wall up there. A little prey item swims over here. They feel it. They slowly move over there. We believe the reason it's got such a flat snout and really big is to increase the surface area for those sensory canals. The more you have, the more you can navigate. Just think of a paddlefish or a shovel-nosed sturgeon. They've got that long paddler, that big wide head, because they have electric sensory detecting organs to feed on the bottom of the river or on plankton. And these Alabama cavefish, the same thing. They have that wide head to try to increase the amount of sensory hairs they've got to navigate their way around Key Cave.
That is so cool. And these guys are not big fish.
No, you have limited nutrients in a cave system. Pretty much everything there's no sunlight, so there's no primary production. So everything has to be brought into the cave by bats or washed into the cave from above. Alabama cavefish maybe get about 4 inches We have seen, though, three different size classes from less than an inch up to almost 4 inches. And so we know that they've been reproducing. I just looked and saw when the first time I collected an Alabama K-fish, that was 1992. How did that be 32 years ago? I don't understand.
So, Nick, maybe you can set the stage in terms of the setting.
The only place in the world this fish lives and resides in Key Cave. And so Key Cave is along the Tennessee River in northern Alabama. I've been in the cave with Bernie. It's been mapped. There's about 12,000 feet of passages. And if you've been in caves in the area, its characteristics are unique in the fact that there's a lot of very tight squeezes and crawls, and it's very difficult to traverse. It's a complex cave. There is water flow through the cave, groundwater movement. So that's where this fish comes in. There's a deep history. I'm still learning myself, but this goes back to 1967, when the fish was first discovered by Cooper, and it was listed as threatened in 1977, and then endangered in 1988. It resides in several small pools that we know of.
Super cool. I'm getting claustrophobic just thinking about crawling around in there.
I always take a real caver in a cave with me so I don't die.
When I was down studying fisheries in Georgia, the folks in the hydrology department were always going over to Alabama and up to Tennessee and going caving and coming back with these cool LIDAR images showing the topology in there and stuff. What is it about the geology down there in the Southeast that results in all these caves coming up?
That's a great question, guys. This whole area, we call the TAG, Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia area, is really dense in caves. Mel Wheeler, National Wildlife Refuge, it's in Decatur, Alabama. We manage now 8 National Wildlife Refuges out of this office. 3 of them are cave refuges: Key Cave, Sauter Cave, and Fern Cave. And this area is part of the Cumberland Plateau. It has a limestone topography. Within a limestone system, water moves through the aquifer, and there's a lot of crevices and caves and formations in this limestone area. So that's why it's so unique. If you came to this area, there is a lot of cavers. There is a lot of caves. It is a very cave-dense area.
Very cavey.
Very cavey.
Do you remember the first time that you got down into Key Cave, Bernie?
I do. What's amazing about Key Cave, it's a multi-level cave. So you can have a caver up above you in a passage, and there'll be a hole in his floor in your ceiling, and he'll say hi to you. And I'll just never forget the first pass, the first pool, you got to slide down about 50 feet of this bat guano pile that slopes at a 45-degree angle. Of course, you're trying to keep the bat guano from rolling down the hill into the pool that you're going to observe.
Wow.
And then the second pool, it's basically a wormhole in the floor. You got to wiggle your way down. There's a bunch of big rocks and stuff. Then you open up to this really big chamber. The pool's about 20 feet deep on the far side. And then you work your way further back into the cave, and you got your feet on one side of the passage, your butt on the other, and you got to scoot down the passage because there's just water beneath you and really no place to stand. And then there's some crawling in a muddy tube, and then you finally get to the pit, a 15-foot deep pit, way far in the back. And it just is an amazing cave, and it's not only got the Alabama K-fish, it's got the Phantom Cave crayfish, only found in 3 caves globally. It's got the Alabama Cave crayfish. It's got Southern cavefish. Nobody knew it till I found one in 1995. We thought the Alabama cavefish was the only cavefish in there. And then I found a really big southern cavefish. And since then, we found juvenile southern cavefish in there, too. And I think I'm seeing the same southern cavefish. He's well over 5 inches long now, approaching 6 inches total length. And he looks like Jabba the Hutt. He's so fat. And then we did surveys around Key Cave in 1999 looking for other populations, because after we discovered the southern cavefish, we're like, well, maybe there are other caves with southern cavefish. And so we looked at 7 or 8 caves. We didn't find any, but I discovered a cave shrimp And there's only two cave shrimp in the United States, the Alabama cave shrimp around Huntsville and the Kentucky cave shrimp up in Mammoth Cave, the only other cave that has two species of cave fish. And so we've named this the Tuscumbia cave shrimp because Key Cave is in the Tuscumbia limestone formation. And for 10 years, I looked for it in Key Cave and couldn't find it. And then in 2009, I found a cave shrimp there, and I found it 3 months in a row after not finding it for 10 years, or I guess 32 years. And that's what's so cool about caves. Just think of the Key Cave National Wildlife Refuge. It's a little over 1,000 acres, and there were three parking lots on the edge. And to census all the wildlife in that 1,000 acres, all you could do was go to the edge of the parking lot and look. And you have to be in that parking lot, and the animals have to be on the edge of the refuge for you to see them. That's what happens in Key Cave. You've got this huge aquifer that humans can only get to a small percentage of. And they come up in these little windows where humans can see them, these pools and the passages. And you have to be there and the animal has to be there at the same time. So it just so happened that the cave shrimp and I never met for 20 some years. And then we finally met 3 months in a row.
And this is the undescribed cave shrimp.
Bernie, you mentioned sliding down that back guano, and I'm curious what you wear when you go in a cave. Like, what kind of pants are you wearing?
So I wear a pair of boots, and I have a cave suit that's basically a jumpsuit with material that's indestructible over the top. Now, if I'm going to be snorkeling in the pools to really get a good look at all the aquatic life there, I'll put on a wetsuit under the caving suit, because I won't have a wetsuit left if I don't have a caving suit over for protection. It smells like the last frontier for biology is what it smells.
Okay. Cool.
But yes, I have been snorkeling in the guano slope pool. There is back guano on my mask, in my ears.
What's visibility like? I imagine you have to be using a headlamp.
I wear a headlamp that's waterproof, and I have a dive light, but the water's crystal clear most of the time. I've gone in there before when it's been milky white after a big rain event, but the limestone over the top of Key Cave, as it works its way down into the aquifer rainwater, it does a pretty good job of filtering and cleaning it up, so it's really clear.
It's time for a Minute with Maria. I'm Maria Dosal, calling in from Chogyang Lands here in Dillingham, Alaska. I just wanted to give a big kagasakun to our guests, Bernie and Nick, for talking to us about the incredible Alabama cavefish. After listening to their words, I had to go do some research. Looking at a picture of them, my first initial reaction was, this fish kind of looks like a snot goblin with the opacity of it. It was such a beautiful story to hear about how this fish lurks around in the depths of the darkness without any eyes. It just makes me wonder what other kind of beauty we can find hanging around in the waters of Alabama and elsewhere and in the depths of the deep oceans. I hope that we keep finding more of these discoveries and mysteries. Can't wait to hear more about what Bernie and Nick have to say. So thank you, big kagasakun to our guest. So I also wanted to give credence to the mistakes that I've been making in saying kagasakun incorrectly. As an Unangak woman, we are still learning about our language because it's mostly lost language and there's not very many native speakers left. So in conversation with my mentor, she said that I'm not saying it correctly. So I want to just give an apology here publicly and say that I'm working on my language and speaking my language more.
These fishes that are hard to access, clearly very rare, how do you balance trying to study them and also trying to protect them?
That is the balance. You're exactly right. That is the balance. And that's something that we contend with as a conservation agency. It's not just a disturbance to Alabama cavefish, but one thing we really haven't talked about yet is the gray bat roost. Gray bats are endangered, and each summer, gray bats use Key Cave as a bat roost. We're looking at seasonality of when we can go in the cave and when we can allow researchers like Bernie to go in the cave. We have to be mindful of that time period from May to September, or maybe we go in after the bats emerge at night. We also, at the same time, is we have to make sure these questions that we answered, that we want to answer, are valid. Is the cost worth the benefit? We obviously want to go in with minimal people, with experts, you know, people that have been caving before, they know the cave. There's a lot more unknowns than knowns, for sure. We just want to make sure we're just being strategic about it.
What are some of the big questions you still want to get answered about these fish? Like, do we know how many there are? How are they doing? But what are some of the burning questions?
Just their biology. We know nothing about it. Really, the entire family of cave fishes, including the surface cave fishes, swamp fish and spring cave fish, they disappear underground and spawn and then come back into the swamps or springs, but no caver has ever seen them in caves. We don't. There's just these mysteries throughout the cave fish family, including the Alabama cave fish. We have really no idea how big the population is. I need to read a sentence from a report from John Cooper, who is a co-describer who discovered it. And so in the literature, it says less than 100, less than 100, less than 100. Here's how he came up with less than 100. Much of the aquatic habitat is inaccessible to sampling and observation, and its actual extent is unknown. A reasonable guess on the number would probably be less than 100. So based on zero data and with two qualifiers, he came up with less than 100. Now that's in the literature.
That's what you got, yeah.
So we have no idea.
And what we do know out of all the excursions and endeavors of sampling, I think at any one time somebody could say they saw probably 12, is that right?
Different. That's the maximum I've seen. Yep.
That's what we have. That's what we know.
Right. Would it be possible to try and take water samples and see if you could get an estimate of population size sort of from a given pool looking at eDNA?
I think where we are with eDNA right now is it would be a great tool to look for additional populations of Alabama cavefish and other caves. Being able to pick a gene and not knowing anything about the variation in genetic material between individuals of Alabama cavefish, it would be an extreme extrapolation. Okay. At where we are in the science right now, you'd really need a whole lot more of the genome sequence to be able to identify individuals with environmental DNA.
Just to add to that, there's a professor at the University of Alabama Huntsville, Matt Niemiller, who has done some eDNA in Key Cave. He's done a lot of that work throughout northern Alabama, in many, many caves. We knew the Alabama cavefish was in Key Cave, but he had the assay and he did detect Alabama cavefish in Key Cave, but not caves in the area. To me, that's huge. I think there's a lot of things that could be done more with eDNA. There's some additional caves downstream of Key Cave that Matt did not assess that we can continue to look in. If you think about it, humans can only access certain portions of Key Cave, right? So this fish might access other areas that humans can't. So can we utilize water from wells in the aquifer to get maybe positive tests elsewhere in the aquifer? Today, as we're kind of on the cutting edge of it, it has its limitations, like Bernie pointed out, but there's definitely utility for it.
Interesting. Do we know what they're eating?
They probably eat that little undescribed cave shrimp. There's also aquatic isopods and amphipods, little pill bugs and little side swimmer scuds in there. They probably eat each other. The two species of cave crayfish, I'm sure they eat smaller ones. The organic material in there, like leaves and sticks and bat guano, probably the crayfish feed on that and the other crustaceans, and they feed upon them. There's only 9 specimens of Alabama cavefish in museums, and all of them are the holotype or paratypes. So no one's cut open a stomach to see what they eat, because the specimens are useful from a taxonomic purpose.
And you probably don't want to mess with any of those food web links either. So your point, Nick, of limiting entry and being very careful and thoughtful about who's going in there, it seems like each of those is probably pretty important.
Exactly. And I think this would be a good time to bring up the importance of the gray bat having a maternity roost site there, you got to think about the basis of the food web. Where does this organic matter come from? In a cave, which normally is limestone and doesn't have that, it's just parent materials. The gray bat guano, gray bat poop is the start of this food chain. So if the gray bats go away, just even small things can change this fragile ecosystem. It's not open to the public. Most of the people that would go in would be researchers, like I said, and what they're doing, and would go into a special use permit.
We talked about the blind forms of the Mexican tetra on a previous episode, and they talked about how the bats were eating moths, and then the tetras were eating the guano. You could actually see the moth scales showing up in the excrement from the tetras. So what are these bats eating?
Same thing. Around the cave entrance, it's forested, and that's typically what gray bats use to forage in. You know, it's right on the Tennessee River. That's why the Key Cave site is so important for them for roosting, because literally they emerge and they can forage right along the forested landscape and over the water. So it could be mayflies, moths, any kind of aquatic emergent bug that would be over the water.
All right, cool. So we got to make sure that those are all protected, like Katrina and you guys were saying, each step along the food chain there. Well, what's the evolutionary history of these fish? How did they all kind of separate and speciate from one another? What's sort of their most, what's their closest relative that's not a cave fish? Amblyopsid.
So they're in the order Percopsiformes. That includes trout perch, pirate perch, perches, and cave fish. The aforementioned Matt Niemiller, for his dissertation, he actually looked at the diversity within the southern cave fish, and he also looked at the rhodopsin gene, which is a gene that regulates eyesight, to get an idea of how many times cave fish invaded underground. And it turns out that the family itself is about 12.3 million years old. The first species to differentiate from the common ancestor was the swamp fish, which makes sense because it's on the Atlantic slope. All the other members of the family are in the Mississippi River system somewhere. Then next is the Ozark cave fish. It branched off about 10.2 million years ago. Then the two spring cave fishes, the Shawnee Hills spring cave fish and the regular old spring cave fish, their closest relative is the northern cave fish and the recently described Hoosier cave fish. And then the last group is the Alabama cave fish, which has been distinct for about 7 million years. And then all of those southern cave fish, which includes the newly elevated Missouri cave fish. And Matt says that there are likely up to 15 species still to describe in the southern cave fish complex.
Well, that's very cool.
That's what's amazing. So this Alabama cave fish has been around for 7 million years. That's before the Pleistocene, before the glaciers. River systems were completely different throughout North America. And it has just sat there in Key Cave with a lot of stuff changing, I'm sure, in the cave and around the cave. But it has been isolated in that aquifer for 7 million years, just putting along, doing its thing. That's pretty amazing.
It always seems tenuous for a species when it's just in one very specific location. What are some other external influencers that could potentially threaten this fish?
We can step back and look at the landscape. What's really fascinating about this particular area in northern Alabama really is the Tuscumpia limestone. And so water moves through this limestone. If you look at this area, it's very deceiving. There's not a lot of creeks and drains and things like that. Most of the streams are these underground streams. This area is very dense in what we call sinkholes. The water drains down through there, and it may go through these underground streams that you may not even see. There's been several dye tracing tests to figure out this groundwater movement and where it's coming from. So in this particular area, a Key Cave, we know that this recharge area, this area of groundwater movement, is about a 16 square mile area. any changes, you know, urbanization, industry, anything that could change the water, all that's going to Key Cave and one or two other caves. If you look at the landscape, it's very, it's rural right now. About 95% is private land. Of that land, about 90% is agriculture, some row crop. There's a lot of pasture, things like that. But any major change that could affect water quality and quantity, it could potentially be a big deal. It's really nice to have the refuge that sits right over it that's tied up in conservation and perpetuity. It's a little over 1,000 acres. That's less than 10% of the recharge aquifer. There's still a lot of work yet to be done for its protection goes, but there has been a lot of work.
That's pretty cool to be a landowner in those 16 square miles. Like, I'd be interested to know that if I was sitting in that recharge area, that cool cave. That's neat.
Just because it's a rural area doesn't mean there aren't threats. So all those herbicides and pesticides and fertilizers that are used on those farm fields work their way relatively quickly because it is a karst sort of Swiss cheese system into the aquifer that feeds Key Cave. And the fish did not evolve with farming over the top. It evolved with forests and grasslands over the top of it. And then when Pickwick Reservoir was built, it flooded Collier Spring, which was the main outflow for that aquifer and from Key Cave. And so now it's redirected most of the flow to a different spring, Woodland Spring, and the flow through Key Cave has slowed up. And the negative with that is if you do have pollutants, their flow through time in Key Cave has been reduced. So those pollutants are around a lot longer if you get a spike of pollutants from a rain event.
So what are some of the things that the refuge is either doing now or looking forward that might be possibilities to try and address some of this? How far upstream in the basin does the refuge go?
The refuge overlays Key Cave. So it's a sense at the bottom, right over Key Cave, right before it flows into the Tennessee River. There's a lot of work done in the 2000s with restoring the refuge to, you know, grassland and planting trees. There is also off refuge. You have the Farm Bill program. You still have NRCS who works with landowners to improve stream bank stabilization, to set aside and plant grasses and trees around Welland. When we acquired the land, it had previously been farmed. There was a lot of erosion, no stream buffers, no wetland buffers. So the refuge after it was purchased in 2000 really did a lot of that work to stabilize the erosion, plant things back to grasses and trees.
The problem with that is we think most cave fishes, they synchronize when they're going to spawn by winter floods. It actually changes the temperature of the cave, changes the flows, brings more nutrients, and that allows the males and females to start producing gonads development to spawn at the same time. Well, if you shunt off a large portion of that rainwater to keep pollutants out, you're decreasing those flood events and those cues for them to spawn because they don't have the sunlight. They don't have the really big changes in water temperature. That was one big problem.
I'm curious from both your positions, you know, the public can't visit this cave. How are you outreaching to people about this fish? And I guess, Bernie, what's the role of the aquarium, the Tennessee Aquarium, if any, with this fish or similar fishes?
We do have a Freshwater Information Network webpage here at the aquarium, and we do have an account for the Alabama cavefish with some photos. Doing this podcast is a great way to reach out and let people know about this awesome fish in this awesome cave with so many other cool critters. It's really hard to sell a fish that no one can go see and is white and no eyes. But you just have to get on its level to know just how unique and cool it is. And it's the canary in the coal mine. About 40% of folks in the Southeast get their drinking water from wells and groundwater. And if the Alabama cavefish and all those other guys that live with it in Key Cave start getting in trouble, that means humans are starting to get in trouble with their drinking water. And so keeping Key Cave, the Alabama cavefish, and all of our caves throughout the Southeast healthy for these aquatic critters means that we're keeping people that rely on well water safe and healthy. So it's a win-win for everybody.
While the public can go and see this fish, we just recently had an exhibit update at our Wheeler National Wildlife Refuge Visitor Center. And so we speak specifically on the Alabama cavefish and the other cave critters. And we have a new, really nice cave exhibit. So that would be another place that someone wanting to learn and see a picture of the fish and learn more about its environment, they could come visit us here at Wheeler National Wildlife Refuge as well.
And there's other places too. They do, like the National Fish Hatchery there at Neosho down in southern Missouri. You know, I was up there looking for Topeka shiners, and they had a whole little exhibit on the Ozark cavefish that I think lives in one of the areas where they have a spring water for their hatchery.
I'd encourage people to look at pictures of the fish. They are just bizarre and cool looking. And I think hearing your stories about going into the cave, that kind of can take you there. There's a lot of places that people don't get to go see if it's like a remote refuge out in the Pacific or wherever. But I think having those stories from folks who have been there and researchers, that's a really neat way to visualize what it might be like. I could smell the bat guano when you were talking. Yeah. So I'm curious if you have any calls to action to landowners or to people in the Alabama area about this fish or about ways they can help the fish or the bats or the moths or anything like that?
On the surface, it's just not obvious. You can't see the stream and sediment or whatever going into your stream. What we do on the surface affects things below the surface, and it has an effect on us with our drinking water. You may have a wetland or pothole that, you know, if you're doing agriculture, it's not very profitable anyway. When it may be a time to reach out, there's government programs that help with this. Reach out to your private lands biologist and say, hey, can I get government help and subsidy to turn this back into a natural wetland? I'm not going to farm it anymore. These little things that we can do, I think, can go a long way in conservation.
There's another little endangered fish that nobody knows about. It's Laurel Dace, which is a little minnow found up on one small section of the Cumberland Plateau, Walden Ridge. And NRCS has a regional conservation partnership program where you can focus large amounts of money. We got $10 million over 5 years to do BMPs on agricultural land for that particular species.
So best management practices?
Yes, best management practices. And we just had a meal at a church up on Walden Ridge, and 12 farmers showed up that have never been in a federal farm bill program to have improvements on their land, and they were excited about it. So my dream is that we can get one of these regional conservation programs going in farms in the recharge area for Key Cave and have a concentrated effort to improve the farming through maybe changing some of those cotton fields to pastures, fencing cattle out of those sinkhole areas, and lower no-till farming, reducing the amount of agricultural chemicals put on the fields, and really make a difference in the water quality in Key Cave.
Well, very good. Thank you both for joining us. This was fascinating.
Yeah, we appreciate it. That was very fun.
Yeah. I enjoyed it. It's really nice to be able to share a story of a fish that nobody has ever seen before.
And thanks to you too, as always, your great hosts.
We'll get out there and live from, discover and enjoy all the fish like the Alabama cavefish, and be sure to go visit your local National Wildlife Refuge and the Tennessee Aquarium. Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. My name is Katrina Liebeck and my co-host is Guy Uro. Fish of the Week is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region Office of Communications. Our production partner for the series is Citizen Race Car. We honor, thank, and celebrate the whole community, individual tribes, states, our sister agencies, fish enthusiasts, scientists, and others who have elevated our understanding and love as people and professionals of all the fish.
I do have a fun story. So the scientific name of the Alabama cavefish is Spheoplateritis polsoni. And that last part, the specific epithet, is named after Tom Polson, who's a world-famous cave biologist. Well, in 2008, he showed up at Key Cave. He'd never seen this fish named after him before. And I was able to go down and get one in a container full of cave water and bring it up to the entrance of the cave and let him see a fish that was named after him.
I just think of Fight Club when I hear that name. That's what I was thinking. Robert Paulson.